I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, hey, welcome to Page Break. I'm your host, Brian McClellan, coming to you from the dry summer slopes of the mountains of Utah. Today's guest is podcaster, tech journalist, and author Tom Merritt. Tom has a wildly prolific career, starting in local radio and working for CNET, the Twit.tv network, and numerous freelance radio, writing, and podcast gigs. He currently hosts the Daily Tech News Show and Cord Killers, as well as the science fiction and fantasy podcast Sword and Laser. We talk about Tom's storied career across multiple media, the intersection of audiobooks and podcasting, as well as Tom's forays into science fiction. Enjoy my chat with Tom Merritt. How have you been doing?
I'm doing great because I just got back from a vacation for the first time in a couple of years.
Oh, man, that's great. Where'd you go?
We went to Honolulu.
Ooh. You know, I really want to go to Hawaii.
I had never been to Hawaii until I moved out to California. And then my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, her friends were getting married in Kauai. That was my first time going, and I just got hooked. I love the place. Because it's relatively cheap from California, both San Francisco and LA.
Yeah.
We've kind of made it our default vacation when we can't think of anything else. You know, we just jet off there for, you know, a cheap flight. We have some friends who live there and it's great.
Right, man. Yeah. Because I priced out tickets for Hawaii a couple of years ago, and it's not that much cheaper than trying to go to Europe, you know, from Salt Lake, you know,
flying out of any small airport. Put one more hop in there, because the tickets this time were the most expensive we've had in a long time, because everything's high right now.
Yeah.
You know, with everybody traveling again. But we've had some times where, you know, we spent less than $200 on plane tickets.
Dang. That's man, that sounds real nice. I've been feeling that itch of just wanting to get out of the house and go do things. And, like, you know, currently the get out of the house is all of the random errands that I put off a year, like car checkups and junk like that.
Yep. That was us a week ago. We were like, you know, the big excitement was getting an oil change. Ooh, we're leaving the house. and then we went on this trip, and it's funny, like, the first few days were very cautious, you know, like, okay, what are we comfortable doing? Like, the whole idea behind the vacation was, like, even if we just stayed in the hotel the whole time and just looked out, you know, made sure we got a room where you could see the ocean, like, that would be better than what we had going on. But by the end of the trip, we were dining inside and, you know, like, you know, living the life. We got back here, we're like, how did we stay in this house
right here? Right. Oh, man, it's tough. You know, I've been having these conversations over the last couple of weeks with a bunch of different friends, and it's interesting how people react, because some people seem to be very cool with, like, yeah, I mean, I'm a creative person. I always stay at home anyways. It didn't really make a difference. And other people are kind of like, oh, yeah, stir crazy within a few weeks. You know, this has been horrible. You know, I work out of my home, but I still have an active social life and all that.
Yeah, because I didn't really change. Remember in the very earliest days of lockdown, people were like, how are you dealing with lockdown? I'm like, my wife's home instead of at work. That's my big difference. Like, I've been doing this show from home since 2014. My routine was I would put on a mask when I would walk the dog instead of, you know, not. But that routine didn't change. But I didn't realize until we actually did travel how much of a difference travel makes. You know, I didn't know how much I was missing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I had finally gotten to the point in 2019 where I was, you know, I was going on trips probably, I don't know, 6 to 8 times a year.
Oh yeah.
And it, you know, and I really enjoy that. I like, I'm a homebody normally, but I like getting out for a weekend, you know, go to a convention and all that mm-hmm. stuff. And having that kind of cut out from under me, you know, it's a little killer. We had to cancel a big trip to Italy that we had planned as a couple. Oh, and so we're already thinking about maybe doing London next spring. But we're doing the same thing where we're kind of like, okay, what are we comfortable with planning? Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know what, you know, are there going to be, you know, crazy variants of the pandemic that are going to come out this fall? And is it going to go back into lockdown? We don't know what's going to happen. So.
Well, and that was one of the reasons we were comfortable doing Hawaii is because they handled the virus so well. Their caseloads have been the lowest of all 50 states.
Yeah.
They were very strict about getting in. You had to, even if you were vaccinated, which we both were, you had to have a negative test within 72 hours of your departure, and you had to have it uploaded, you know, to their website. So on arrival, they were checking, it was pretty strict. So I felt pretty comfortable. Like, okay, if I'm going to go somewhere, this is probably one of the more controlled places that I could go.
Yeah, man, that sounds great. I can't wait until I start doing stuff again. I was reading a little bit about you, just kind of, you know, shuffling through, and this is something that kind of stood out to me that I find really funny. Your dad was a food scientist?
Yeah. Yeah. He was a dual major in psychology and chemistry, but he used mostly the chemistry.
Yeah.
And he was at one point the world's leading expert on evaporated milk.
So I don't know. I think some people would find that incredibly boring. I find that stupidly fascinating. because I don't know. I'm always interested in people who are like leading people in their field in something that not many people do.
Yeah.
I'm always really fascinated by that. Was that something that ever was a thing around the dinner table? Did your dad talk about food when you were eating?
Oh yeah. Not only that, but we would be eating the food that he was developing quite often. I didn't really realize how odd it was growing up, because it was just the way things were, like anything is when you're growing up. But we had tacos every weekend on Saturday because one of the brands he worked on was Old El Paso. So he would be bringing back like seasoning packets and hot sauces and things. And I remember him being like, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And I just, at the time, just thought like, oh, dad's really interested in, you know, what I like. And he was experimenting on us, basically, you know, he was trying to see like what stuff we liked and what stuff we didn't. I remember we had these unmarked boxes of ice cream that he would serve us ice cream. And then he's like, tell me if you find anything weird. And I remember one time I found this like rubbery bit and I told him about it. And he just started taking notes. I was like, okay, yeah, no, that's good. And then a couple of times later, he would serve me ice cream and be like, did you find any rubbery bits? And I'm like, no. He's like, good.
Oh, that's funny. Once you were an adult, did you ever talk to him about that?
Oh, yeah. Because he retired. He did an early retirement. So I was off to college when he retired, but when I'd come home, I would say like, I now realize just how much experimenting you did. And he'd be like, an experiment on you? It was all, you know, it was all safe food. I just wanted to find out what your opinions were, you know,
because
there was somebody outside the bubble that could give me some feedback that I wouldn't get otherwise.
Oh, that's funny. I had a conversation with my dad about, I think it was 2 years ago, where I was trying to find out a little bit more about my grandpa, about his dad. Mm-hmm. And his dad, he had been one of the, I think it was radio engineers on the program that followed up the Manhattan Project.
Oh, the Brooklyn Project?
I have no idea. It was the, but so he worked for the government, you know, working on the ancillary stuff of, you know, the nukes, basically. And my dad talked about not really knowing what his dad did, but having his dad bring home these big like schematics and laying them all out on the like living room floor and stuff, and occasionally showing him things that he now realizes are top secret.
Oh my gosh.
And being like, oh, hey, look at this. I designed this, you know, little bit of electronics here. And I just, you know, I find that kind of, it's funny because, you know, nowadays, you know, somebody would TikTok something like that.
Right. But it would be a scandal or something. Yeah.
Yeah. But being a kid in the 50s, you know, or for you, for, you know, the 70s, you know, like growing up, you know, having your dad bring his work home and talk about that kind of stuff. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. Being experimented on with food was a thing growing that's, up. A lot of my favorite foods never made it to market.
Oh, man. That's funny. Did you watch the first episode of the new Loki show?
Yeah. Yeah, we did. In fact, the nice thing about being in Hawaii is we got to watch it at 9 on Tuesday.
Oh, hey, that's great. No, I thought one of the funny things with it is that they like had all of these discontinued foods in the background at the TVA.
Uh-huh.
You know, like it's such a weird little detail to add in. But hey, I mean, if you have command of all space and time, then why not eat the foods that you like, right?
Or you pick stuff up and bring it back into the office and forget about it. And it could be from any time, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's going to be discontinued in some timeline probably, right?
How are all the podcasts going? Do you have 5 regular podcasts right now?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I do a daily show, the Daily Tech News Show.
Yeah.
And then I do a weekly called Cord Killers. Sword and Laser is every other week. It's a Thing is every week. And then I have some more periodical ones. Current Geek's on hiatus. That would have been the 5th. East Meets West is monthly. Then I also occasionally will do Let's Talk About Star Wars. And and I do a top 5 video for Tech Republic that comes out weekly.
Does it stress you out to create content on a daily, well, normally weekly, but also daily? Is that overwhelming to you?
It is stressful, but I really enjoy it, or I wouldn't continue to do it. I got into media in radio in the late 80s. And just got used to that regular schedule of you're going to be striped Monday through Friday. I got into tech and the web when I was working at Tech TV in 1999, and that was on daily shows, two mm-hmm. daily shows. And so I kind of never known any other way. I've always joked that like I'm really really not smart in that every time I have a chance to start a new show, I make it daily. Instead of scaling back. But I don't know. There's something about it that's fun.
And so, I mean, I guess if you really break it down, it's just a job, right? You just have your schedule and you do it.
Yeah, well, one of the keys is I do it live. We stream it so that there's no, hold on, let me do that again, right? You just, you've got to plow through it, and it's a 30-minute show. So you get your 30 minutes and then it's done. If you do something, either a video shoot or an audio recording that's 30 minutes, it might take you a half a day if you're not trying to do it live. Even if it's not streamed live, you know, if you're doing it live, what they used to call live to tape, it makes a difference because you're not stopping down and talking about it and redoing and going, well, that was pretty good, but let me do another one. You just get it done.
Right. Oh, that's fascinating. When did you start being the personality on the other end of the radio?
So my first job was at a country music station that was heavy metal at night. and I did both. I did some shifts in the country and some in the what they called the rock zone.
Yeah.
And that was in 1986 when I was 16 years old. I got that job.
That's the year I was born.
Really? Yeah. My radio career and you are the same age.
I know. That's fantastic.
Yeah. So I did that. That was in my hometown, but it was a commercial station. And I did that for a few years. And then I worked in radio stations in high school in radio stations in college. And then I was sort of off mic behind camera, the late 90s in Austin, I was my misspent youth. I worked at a bookstore. I did some pirate radio station for a little bit, and I did theater stuff, and I started my website. It was, you know, kind of all over the place. But then, yeah, then I got into Tech TV, the television network, as a web producer.
Yeah.
And I really didn't go back in front of the camera or on the mic until I moved to CNET in 2004 and started doing videos and podcasts for them.
Do you, I mean, I guess maybe this is a dumb question because you are the guy doing it now, but do you like doing the behind the scenes, or do you prefer to be in front of the microphone / camera?
I've always preferred to do the behind the scenes stuff. The,
really?
The preparation and the production is the part that I find the best. Being in front, being on mic and on camera is a rush, right? That's the fun thing where you're performing. But you know, and I'm not trying to have false modesty and say, no, I don't want the spotlight. You know, I'm an attention grabber person just like everybody else. But I do find the most satisfaction in crafting the stuff and putting it together.
Well, because it is an art, you know, like I just playing with it, the very small amount I did before I said, you know, screw this, I'm hiring an engineer, it's an art. It's an art to craft, whether it's your own or someone else's, you know, their schedule and their plan. And then afterwards you have to do the editing and listen back and all of that stuff. That's a very particular set of skills.
And what I really enjoy is the news commentary format and figuring out, like, okay, what are the most important things to put in this 30 minutes today that's going to help people understand things? You know, how many minutes should we give them? How should we set it up? What are the things we make sure we include? How do we make sure we have an interesting conversation about it? That's the stuff I really enjoy.
Yeah. I was actually curious about the idea, especially nowadays. You basically professionally, you have opinions professionally.
Mm-hmm.
You go on and you talk about things and you have opinions about technology and consumer products and TV and books and everything. Is that a struggle to deal with sometimes? Because I kind of avoid having public opinions because I'm a semi-public person. And so I don't want to pick fights and things like that. Is it different when having opinions is your job?
Yes, it is. And there's two ways people go about it. One is to lean into it and be the controversial, you know, I'm just gonna, you know, go one direction and hate everybody who disagrees with me. And that is the more successful way to go, apparently, from what I can tell. But also, not my personality type to deal with, because that's when you really are going to have to deal with all of that hate and backlash and everything that you're talking about. What I've done, one of the nice things about doing a news oriented show is that, you know, you can have a balance of opinions, and that's what I've tried to do, is say, like, all right, let's always look at the other side. Let's not just say Google is evil. Let's, you know, why would Google want to do this besides being evil? And let's not let them off the hook either. Let's also, you know, hold them accountable when it's appropriate. But, you know, how do we look at all the various angles? And it's not just two sides. There's always multiple things to think about. So I've sort of cultivated that, which I think helps, because, you know, I try to talk about Android as much as I talk about iPhone, for instance. And so for every person who gets mad at me for talking about one side, I can say, like, yeah, but I also talk about this other. I also try to cover. I'm not trying to say I'm perfect, but that sort of helps mute that sort of anger. And I don't know how you deal if somebody does come at you, but you know, people do, they get angry at you. And I try to just listen to what I think they want to say, not what they're saying. Like if they were in the room with you being a you know, civil person, you know, would they have a point? If not, then I just don't engage. Yeah. But if they do, then I try to respond to that. And oftentimes that I mean, just the act of responding sometimes is enough, but sometimes responding sincerely to like, okay, I think I know what your point is, can help a lot. But, you know, then there's also trolls and bots and stuff, and you just got to ignore that, or let it go, move away. So many, over the years, I've developed so many little strategies, you know, write the angry response, but don't post it, that kind of thing. Do you have any of that in your tool set?
Man, you know, I kind of reached the point where I don't engage with negative feedback.
Yeah.
I try not to even read it. Mm-hmm. Because two things are going to happen. One, it's either somebody who clearly didn't read very well, and I'll just be annoyed and I'll have wasted my time and my emotional energy, or it'll be somebody who has a point, and that's almost worse, because then I'll be like, oh crap, they're right, I screwed that up, oh man.
And it's not like you have a show the next day that you can go on and correct yourself, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. Do you think that you have, in terms of your audience, do you think that you've kind of created a pretty positive relationship with them?
I think I have. I'm always hesitant to curse myself by saying I have.
Right.
But yeah, I feel pretty lucky with the people that are in our community. A long time ago when I was at CNET, I don't even think I originated. I think I lifted it off somebody else, but I said, you get the audience you deserve, meaning your audience is a reflection of you.
Yeah.
And so the worst thing I can say about my audience is that they're kind of picky and pedantic. And I'm like, and so am I. So, they, you know, like that's what I get. But they're all, you know, with a very, very rare exception, they're all very kind, sincere people who just, you know, want to enjoy the topic that we're all talking about. So I feel really, really lucky to have that. And I feel really lucky that I was involved both at CNET's Buzz Out Loud and at Tech TV's Screensavers and Call for Help shows, who had amazing communities and were shining examples of how you do community right very early in my career.
Yeah. Do you think of your listeners as fans? And I guess what I mean by that is, do you feel like listeners tend to follow you, Tom Merritt, to whatever shows you're doing or whatever projects you're working on? Or does it kind of develop from whatever audience you're kind of aimed at when you start a new show?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I'm not exactly sure, although I did unintentionally test it when I got let go from Twit, which was the This Week in Tech network that I was at, and I started my own show. There were a lot of people who followed me who said, you know, I just like what you do. I even got some people who said, I didn't realize it was you I liked until you were on your own. And so I think I have some of those people who really like the way I do what I do. And then there are also a lot of people who just want the content, who just, you know, they want to keep up on technology or science fiction, fantasy books or whatever.
Yeah. I ask because when you're an author, you kind of, there's two different types of fans. There tends to be, at least in the genre fiction that I work in. You either have the fans that they like how you write, and they are there for you and they want to read whatever you put out, which is, you know, that's the best kind of fan to have. But you also have the fans that they get invested in a single world. And so they don't really care about you. They don't even know your name. They just know the world that you wrote, and they don't really care what else you've done. And I'm always fascinated by kind of the dichotomy between those two different types of people. Because when I was a kid, I did not know the name of authors. I would know the names of a universe. I'd say, oh yeah, I knew the name of Robert Jordan, but only because I had read, you know, 9 of his books in a single series.
Yeah.
And so I'm fascinated by that. And I'm wondering how much it kind of translates over to other artistic endeavors, I suppose.
Yeah. That's interesting. Cause I know what you're talking about, where somebody's like, no, I like Powder Mage. Why are you doing something else? You know, like
yeah,
you're you don't get to do anything else. I just want more of the thing I like, right? Is that the more common, do you think? It feels like that's the more common response where people are like, no, I just like this series.
I imagine it is by far the most common. And you kind of, you know, as an author, I would say that, man, yeah, I used to have a really good estimate. I think it was 10 to 15% of your readers were the type of people that are going to follow you to a new series. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that varies massively from genre and book and reader and writer and all that stuff. But I guess that would be my estimate, is you have that small percentage. They're loyal. They want you and what you do rather than the particular content.
Well, because it's scary. It's over-dramatizing to say it's not really scary. But, you know, the first time a beloved author writes something that's not in even the same vein, right? Like when Martha Wells started writing Murderbot, for instance. The first time somebody does that, you're like, ooh, I know they're really good at this, but I don't know if they're really good at that. And so that's the jump I feel like people have to take, is like, I know you from this. And if if I'm willing to jump and see if you're good at this other thing, then I might become a fan of you, you know, Brian. But you have to get them to take that leap.
And I was kind of wondering how that translates for you, because you also write science fiction novels. And honestly, I don't know a lot about you writing science fiction novels, because I know Tom Merritt, the podcaster.
Sure, sure. And that's most people. I've successfully taken people from Tom Merritt is a tech guy who does that CNET stuff.
Yeah.
To, you know, he's also science fiction and fantasy books. He's also TV and movie cord cutting. And I've successfully been able to make people make those jumps. I think because I never did just one thing. Even at CNET, I was doing multiple types of shows, even though they were all largely under technology. Getting people to read books, at first there was a, oh my gosh, you wrote a book? That's so cool. Let me try it.
Yeah.
But I have found, well, I found a couple things. I have found it's harder to grow that audience because people are like, yeah, but I only have so much time to spend on you, Merritt. So, you know, I'm going to spend it on the thing I know you do really well. But also, I'm just not very good at prioritizing that side of things, because it is a side thing that I do for my own enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been able to get published with Inkshares on a couple of novels, but everything else has been self-published. So it's really just me loving to write and loving to come up with stories and then writing them. And I would have to take time away from the podcasting to push that farther than I have so far.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. I picked up Gallium this morning.
Really?
Cause I just was doing some research, and I had glanced at your books before because you're my friend, and I hadn't grabbed one before, but then I read the synopsis for Gallium, and I'm like, that sounds fun. I'm going to grab it on Audible. And I was kind of curious about the, doing something like that on audio. I'm wondering, I guess it's a little uncouth for me to say, are your Audible sales a lot better than your ebook sales because you are an audio person?
It's interesting. Yes, but only because the ebook sales are so small. I think it is easier to get a podcast listener to try an audiobook, though. I think that's absolutely true. And that's one thing. Inkshares published two of my books, and the second one, they were able to get a deal with Audible because Audible was like, oh yeah, the sales of the first one were great. And you know, with an actual publisher pushing it and podcast listeners going, oh, you got an audiobook. Great.
Yeah.
I do think that there's something there. In fact, I'm going to self-publish another audiobook that I didn't produce. I like hired someone to make it for me. And it's, you know, it's going to be on the level of the ones I did with Inkshares on my own. And I'll report back. I'll be very curious to see if that works better.
Yeah, it's I'm fascinated by the way that creative people kind of cross-pollinate in various, I don't know what you'd call them, like media genres, I guess.
Or just media, the plural media, I guess.
Yeah, in different media, you know, because I talk to, I'll talk to like a TV writer and they'll say, oh man, I really want to get into novels. That sounds so much fun. Uh-huh. And on my side, I'll go, but man, you're working in Hollywood. You're working on TV shows. That sounds way cooler than what I do. And so it's, do you think that artistic people just like being artistic and they have a drive to create interesting things? And so when a new piece of media kind of crops up, it's going to scratch something, you know, behind their shoulders. And they're going to want to, you know, maybe not always, but you know, there's going to be that tendency to want to jump in and look at something new.
I think there's definitely something to that because, I mean, some of it is the grass is always greener, right? I don't know. There's an old joke of like movie stars all want to be rock stars or rock stars all want to be movie stars, you know, but I think there's also just, especially like you're saying, when there's a new thing, like, you know, a new thing that comes along, I think creative people are like, ooh, I hadn't considered having that as an option as a way to tell my story or express my music or whatever it is. And I think there is a good section of people who are like, oh, I want to try that. I want to see what that's like.
I was talking to Peter Brett for this show just last week, and he was talking about how a while back he picked up a whole bunch of podcasting equipment, all the audio stuff, and he had created a little desk in the corner of his new apartment, and he was really thinking about getting into, you know, oh, maybe I'll make YouTube videos for my fans, maybe I'll do this, maybe I'll do that, and he said that his ultimate conclusion was, oh man, you know, I really want to do these things, but I write books and I do that well, and I need to stick with it. And it's funny because I've thought about starting a podcast for like 4 years. Because I've asked you about podcasts for years. Totally. You know, I do come back to that. You know, do I split my creative attention between multiple things, or do I stick with one thing that I'm really good at?
Yeah, it's easier when you're younger, I think. You know, when I was in my 20s, I could bounce from, oh man, I wish YouTube had been around back then. I could bounce from, you know, this is going to date me so much, from radio to cable access television to theater, you know, and just try different stuff because your brain's more malleable. And I know what Peter's talking about. There's a certain point where you're like, oh, TikTok. Okay. I guess I could wrap my head around that. Whereas, you know, if TikTok had come along when I was 24, I would have been like, oh, cool. What can I do with this? Let me push it to the limit. What's it good for? Let me try stuff. But you get to the point where you're like, I know I'm really good at this, and I only have so much, you know, I only have so much energy, if nothing else. So do I risk not doing what I do well as well because I'm taking time trying to figure out and learn this other thing? Which is what writing for me, I started it when I was young, you know, so I've built momentum, but I never got to the point of like switching to it. It's always been the thing that I do for fun that maybe I can also make something more out of.
Do you think that starting new podcasts and, you know, working on new shows kind of scratches that itch for you?
Totally,
a little bit?
Yeah. In fact, I have to stop myself from starting new podcasts because I will just, like, when the pandemic hit, I started 3 new podcasts because I'm like, hey, I didn't even have more time. It was just like, oh, hey, you know, can't go to the grocery store. I guess I'll start a podcast in that.
What is your kind of personal criteria for whether you continue doing a new show?
That's a good one. I've had good luck and bad luck with that over the years. There have been some shows that just didn't succeed, and I was able to look at it and very, you know, rationally say, like, look, this just doesn't have enough listeners. Maybe the listeners that are there really love it. And that was true in a couple of cases, and people still complain to me that I canceled them, but I'm like, it just, you know, it just wasn't enough compared to the other things that I had going on to keep going. I've also had the situation where I got a lot of irons in the fire and they all got hot, which, you know, sounds like bragging, but really it can it can be a trouble of like, oh, but I can't make any of them melt to push that metaphor too far. Like, because I'm trying to keep them all hot.
Right.
And so you have to finally decide like, all right, I'm going to focus on these and maybe let that one cool a little, even though it's good. And there's the ways I've dealt with that are making things seasonal so that I don't have to work on it all the time, or going on hiatus and then seeing if it comes back. One show I did, called FSL Tonight, we put on hiatus and neither one of us have actually ever talked about it to each other. We have been on panels and answered questions about it.
Yeah.
But we still have never talked about it because I think we both realized that it was more effort to do than it needed, but we both loved doing it together so much that if we talked to each other, we'd talk ourselves into doing it again. So, so we've just avoided the conversation, but, it was a fantasy sports show. So in other words, all the teams were based on fantasy and science fiction properties. And we would just report as if the games had happened and who was in first place.
Yeah. That sounds very funny.
It was so much fun. Yeah. But it was a lot of work.
Yeah. And that's the second thing I was going to say is it sounds like a lot of effort to go into something like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, that making those decisions of what you want to spend your energy on, because, you know, like you can get kind of crass about it and say, well, something's not making money. You know, I can't do this anymore. But, you know, at the end of the day, you only have so much creative energy. Mm-hmm. And even if, you know, you're meeting your needs, you still kind of want to justify whatever you're working on.
Yeah.
You know, to your spouse or to yourself, you know, for whatever. And that's something that you don't talk about a lot in the creative world.
You can only have so many labors of love.
Right. Right. And, you know, you get that thing where there's a lot of writers who will say, well, I would write whether I make money from it or not. And that's fine. And it's, you know, it's awesome to have hobbies like that. But there's also a point at which you can't, you know, you can't kind of justify putting all of that time and effort. And and at times it's, you know, it costs money, too. You know, when you're doing with yourself publishing a book, you know, it's going to cost you probably a couple of grand.
You've got to get, you know, unless you're a perfect editor, which nobody is, you're going to have to get an editor.
Yeah.
And then unless you're also an artist, which very few of us are, you're going to have to get artwork. Like, you know, and those are just the first two basic things you have to do.
Right. Now, with your shows, do you prefer to kind of do everything yourself, or do you prefer to have somebody working on the production for you?
All of my people I work with will say that I prefer to do everything myself because I'm very bad at just like delegating and letting things go. I'm getting better at it, but I prefer to do it all myself. I have forced myself to let go and say, no, that's okay, Veronica, we can hire an editor to do Sword and Laser. That's a good idea. Of course, in that case, Veronica had been doing the editing, not me. But even then I was like, but why do we need to pay? I think my depression era parents were you know, influencing me. Why you pay for something you could do yourself? But it does make sense, honestly, to pay people to do yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, I finally got a virtual assistant about a year and a half ago. And, you know, they're just not even part-time. They're just a little bit of freelance work for just little stuff that stresses me out. Mm-hmm. And that, honestly, I'm not that great at anyways. And so, you know, why not have someone else update my website and things like that?
Well, because there are things that other people are better at than me, right?
Yeah.
So if I were to do it, it would take me three times as long. So even if you're just going to be crass and value your time, like my time is worth more doing something else. Also, it's just better if that person does it faster and probably right, whereas I'll screw it up and have to redo it. So yeah, it just makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Now, you went to school for journalism, right?
I did, yeah. I attended the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and got a Bachelor of Science in Journalism.
What drove that?
I was working at a radio station. It was like, this will be easier if I have my degree overlap with what I'm doing, is really honestly. But, you know, I enjoyed doing the radio work, too. So it was not hard for me to enjoy majoring in journalism. But yeah, I started as an economics major because I was told by my sister, my older sister, that I should go into pre-law, and economics was a good degree for pre-law. And then you go to law school and then you get a law degree. And yeah, even if you don't want to become a lawyer, Tom, you always have that law degree. I did not do that. I did become a history major for a few semesters because I really enjoy history. But I knew that wasn't going to parlay itself into a job directly.
Yeah.
And journalism could. And I was already doing a job in journalism in a media field. So the way University of Illinois worked, you couldn't go into the College of Communications until your junior year.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of just like stayed in history until my junior year. And then I entered the College of Communications and got the journalism degree there. And then I did 1 year of grad school work at University of Texas, Austin as well.
Did you have when you were in school, did you have an ultimate vision of what you wanted to do with that?
No. I mean, yes, I had silly visions. Like I was reading Hunter S. Thompson. So I'm like, I want to be a doctor of journalism. So I'll go to grad school in journalism and really become a doctor in journalism. Yeah. But yeah, I didn't really know. I knew I enjoyed radio. But I also knew that radio didn't pay a lot. So that's where those lost years in Austin come in. I was a total slacker, who I went to grad school for a year, realized that wasn't for me. I was working at a bookstore, which I loved because, you know, free books to read all the time. And I just sort of like felt around, tried different things. And honestly, it was doing my website myself that felt the best. There were two things I was doing by the end of my time in Austin. I was writing a book, the first real full book that I ever finished writing. And I was doing a website, and the website got me a job at a television network that needed people to do their website and had a streaming radio station that I could go and kind of worm my way into, and use my radio. And I was like, that's my dream job. It does all the things that I enjoy doing.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
But I backed into it. I definitely didn't have the vision or plan of that.
What did your parents think of you going into journalism?
I mean, my parents were actually pretty supportive of me doing what I wanted to do. They, you know, it wasn't like my dad was like, "You're going to be a food scientist like your father." My grandpa on my mom's side was a little more skeptical. He was like, "Well, what are you going to do with that? How are you going to make money?"
Yeah,
you know, journalists don't get paid a lot. He was that more traditional voice on it, but journalism wasn't a bad one. He supported my sister's idea of like, you really ought to go to law school, but at least journalism was a practical degree. When I was in history, there it was like, well, you're never going to be a, you know, highly paid historian.
Yeah,
so there was some of that, but my parents, my mom and dad, my mom actually got a job at the radio station I worked at in high school after me. So she was like, yeah, radio's fun. I enjoy radio too. My dad was always very much of the mindset of like, what's important is that you enjoy what you do and then you can find, you know, work that fits that. And I always valued that, you know, he was like that.
Oh, that's very cool. I talking to other creatives, you get a really huge spectrum of, you know, what were your parents like? What, you know, what did they think of you wanting to be artistic in some way? It's always really, it feels nice to me when people are able to say, yeah, my parents supported me.
Yeah, I was very lucky in that respect. I mean, my dad supported me. My mom just sort of, I don't know, she was more of like, yeah, you know, yeah, I'm doing it too. So I guess I can't criticize you.
Yeah, my mom was always incredibly supportive. You know, she's the one that read to me when I was a little kid. She was the one that took me to the library when she was volunteering every week and, you know, let me run around through the stacks. And she was the one that kind of pushed me towards writing. And my dad was always very much kind of bemused by it. Mm-hmm. And kind of, yeah, you know, you should get a degree so that you could get a real job if you need to.
Just as a safety measure.
Right. But he was never a dick about it. He never, you know, said, oh, writing's for idiots or anything like that. Yeah, it's nice when your parents are kind of cool with things.
Yeah, it was, I was very lucky in that respect. I mentioned my grandpa, who's a little more of the traditional, you know, skeptic about, you know, what you're going to do with that. But even he talked to me about it. He didn't just, you know, judge me and condemn me. And my grandma on my dad's side was always much more concerned about, like, well, are you happy? Do you enjoy what you're doing? And she was very not old fashioned. I mean, my grandpa on that side was born in 1883. I come from a very stretched out family. So there, you know, all of my family except my mom had lived through the Depression. And there was, I don't know, there was some practicality built into that of like, yeah, you need to earn a living, but guess what? The world could take away your living no matter what you do. So, you know, maybe be versatile.
That's actually a really interesting attitude, because I've found that my parents' generation, it seems like there's a lot more of a, it doesn't matter what you enjoy, you have the responsibility mm-hmm. of providing for your family, you make the money and you put food on the table and things like that. And I've always found that kind of tragic. So it's fascinating that they were able to kind of step back and say, enjoying what you're doing is important.
Yeah. There was a little bit of a fatalism behind it, I think, of like, you know, you can make all the plans you want and it can all fall apart. So, you know, as long as you are responsibly providing for yourself and your family, then if you're just like skipping out, you know, going to Alaska, you know, leaving kids behind, and then that would not have been okay. You know, but you want to be a journalist, you want to work in radio, like, okay, you know, that's as long as you can make that work.
Right. Right. Well, people listen to radio, so hey, there must be work there.
Right. Right. And now I don't do any, I mean, I don't do radio. I do a version of radio, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. None of my family would have ever understood. In fact, my mom is my only, other than my brother and sister, my only living relative. And she doesn't even listen to podcasts. She's like, you know, that's too weird for her. Although she has an iPhone and she loves it. I'm like, why don't you just get the podcast app? And then she's like, no, that's fine.
That's great. Now, you mentioned working for a bookstore, and you, one of your podcasts is Sword and Laser, which is science fiction and fantasy. Is it still book club?
Yeah.
Or
mostly
interviews?
It's mostly book club. It started as a book club before it became a podcast even.
Yeah.
And the larger audience is the book club, I think still.
Now, where does that kind of love of reading and science fiction in particular come from?
Yeah, I don't know. That there were lots of, my mom was a voracious reader. My dad was a more practical reader, but he read a lot as well. I mean, all my family read. I don't think there was anybody in my family who didn't. So I would just have to say it was my family. And my mom would take me to the library as a young boy during the summers to be part of the reading club that they offered, and you'd get a little sailboat with your name on it every time you read a book. And I was very proud that, you know, I sucked at t-ball. I couldn't kick my way out of the backfield in soccer, but I freaking won that reading thing. My sailboat was way in front of everybody else. Because I knew how to read at an early age. My sister, you know, I should probably credit my sister. My sister taught me to read when I was like two. Ooh. So I was reading well before most of the people in my class.
That's very cool. What do you have a particular memory of something that really clicked with you early on? Like for me personally, it would be either C.S. Lewis, because my mom would read those to me, or it would be anything King Arthur and Robin Hood. Mm. When I was really little, I got really into I was reading stuff that was 10 years more advanced than I should have been reading, because I just wanted to read anything that was, you know, kind of British lore.
Yeah.
Was there anything like that that really clicked for you?
It's funny. When I was in elementary school, I had to get a written note from my mom giving me permission to go to the side of the library where Wind in the Willows was, because I was not at the level that I was supposed to be able to read that. But I would read Wind in the Willows, Dr. Doolittle, Hardy Boys.
Oh, I loved Dr. Doolittle.
Yeah. I loved all that stuff. And then as I got older, I read the Narnia books. I think the thing that really made me take off into reading, I read a lot, but it was like, it was kids stuff like that for the most part. The first adult book that I remember adoring was when, I guess I would have been 13 or 14. We went up to drop my sister off at college. She also went to the U of I, and we went into a Walden Books, and I found Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
And
read it on the ride back.
Yeah.
And I would go and I would reread it immediately. And I would like note like how many times I had read it in the front cover of the paperback.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's fun. That's a good start. I like that. Now, man, we have blown through time. I'll wrap it up with my favorite question, which is, what is a meal that has blown your mind recently?
A meal?
This is a 180, but you know, yeah. I mean, you follow my Twitter. You know how I feel about food.
I do. This is the problem, is that I just came back from vacation, so I have to pick, because there was really good Korean food with like Korean kimchi pancakes and Korean fried chicken. But I'm going to go with the plate lunch from the Poi Factory on the North Shore. It was, do you know what Lau Lau is?
I don't know.
It's pork kind of roasted in banana leaves.
Ooh.
And then, so it was Lau Lau, Kahlua pork, fresh made poi from the factory, and Lomi Lomi salmon, which is like a mixture of not a dried salmon, but like a cured salmon and tomatoes. And then you eat all of that by dipping some of it in the poi. It's so good. So good.
That sounds fantastic.
I
want to
eat my phone that has a picture of it now after talking about it.
Oh, fantastic. Well, hey man, that's great. Thanks so much for coming and hanging out and chatting with me for 45 minutes.
Yeah. Though this was fun. Like you said, the time just flew by. I can't believe it's already been that long.
That was tech journalist and podcaster Tom Merritt. Thanks again to Tom for his time. You can find links to Tom's social media, as well as his books and most popular podcasts, down in the show notes. You can find me, as always, at brianmcclellan.com. Special thanks to James Sutter for music and Tom Bishop for production support. If you'd like to support the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak or buy my books in ebook, paperback, or audio. Don't forget to like and subscribe.